It is time for the Media Beat from David Tereshchuk, his weekly review of media coverage for Robinhood Radio and exclusive to Robinhood Radio. David is a multimedia and international journalist with his own online column at themediabeat.us. And as a special correspondent since 2012, he has contributed TV reports to the PBS network, mostly on ethical issues. Here's David.
This is David Tereshchuk with the Media Beat for the weekend beginning May 31st, 2024. In the media capital of the world, New York City. That's how, not in total seriousness, nor even total agreement, I have habitually described the home base for these broadcasts and podcasts, when I'm not reporting from overseas, of course. Just for a change, this week I'm going to dwell on some good news for the media, and it emanates from New York. Not actually from the city, but from the great state. They're all great states, I've learned to say. The great state of New York. In the state budget for 2024, the whopping sum of $90 million is being set aside as tax credits, tax breaks in most tabloid speak, to be enjoyed by local media outlets to help them survive. In the words of a spokesman for the News Guild Communications Workers of America, the labor union involved, "This is the first time in American history that we have created a tax credit structure to support journalism jobs." Now, the digital revolution's disastrous impact on advertising revenue for local news outlets is a countrywide phenomenon. We've talked often enough in the Media Beat about the creation of news deserts across so much of the nation. So why would New York State be taking the lead in this offering of public assistance, apart from the not very persuasive fact that down at the southern bottom of the state's barrel lies the Big Apple with its media capital moniker? Well, WAGs in the state legislature. It's funny how a WAG, such a quaint old word, or several WAGs will always appear when there's a new comment-worthy law on the books. WAGs are saying the name of the new subsidizing provision should be the George Santos Prevention Act. That's because, for many, it was the dearth of local press coverage that helped propel the disgraced ex-representative for our 3rd congressional district. Remember him? Lack of any journalistic examination at local level enabled him to go as completely undetected as he did for a while, spinning his spectacularly ridiculous web of lies. The not exactly headline-catching real name for the new state measure is the somewhat dull Local Journalism Sustainability Act, and it really does stand to make a massive difference to struggling newsrooms all over the state. On the opposite coast, California is not to be outdone, and its state legislature is considering a measure that still has only an even more mundane title, SB 1327. That's merely the number of the Senate bill involved, hence the SB part. The specifically local trick coming into play there is occasioned by Silicon Valley making up such a gigantic share of the state's economy. The idea is that new financial support for local journalism will consist of a levy placed on the big tech companies, Google, Facebook, and the like. It's in effect a tax imposed on their extraction of data from all of us users. Not before time, some of us might say. Although the size of such costs likely to be incurred by the tech giants would be negligible considering their vast profits, Google especially seemed to be really outraged at the prospect of having to pay such a data mining fee. Its reactions began with some throwing around of its considerable weight, as only a giant can do. For instance, it stopped providing, in its search results, links to a certain proportion of California-based news sites, a sneaky move that would have been unimaginable at some earlier point in the Internet's supposedly free and open development. Google also apparently threatened to abandon the so-called Google News Initiative, the company's own fund for local media organizations, a charitable program, you might describe it, or at least they kind of do so themselves, saying it's a supportive, partnering non-profit. the company said in tones that suggested to me a caricatured mafia don, that the initiative's funding would be paused, quote, until there is clarity on California's regulatory environment. It also flexed its muscles by just happening to launch, during these discussions, its new Pinpoint Gen AI, which looks very much like yet another step in the juggernaut's overall drive to ingest and control news information right across the board. Hardly surprisingly, the battalions of lobbyists who are paid by the major tech companies have descended en masse upon the state capital, Sacramento. The supporters of independent local media will have a tough battle ahead to ensure the bill retains its major and rather radical intentions for reform. Back in New York City, the biggest story for miles around has, of course, been the protracted Donald Trump trial for illegal business record keeping, or as it has to be known in journalistic terms, the hush money case, or better yet, the hush money for porn star case. The arcane arguments as to exactly what might have been Trump's offense, and along with that, can it be classed as a felony because his wrongdoing was in furtherance of concealing another crime, may all be a bit too complicated for most of the news-consuming public. And for some journalists, too, it seems, as we read headlines that have veered unprofessionally close to the wind in prejudging matters. The journalistic problem that besets me is that the jury has retired to deliberate as I write these words, but it may well have returned a verdict by the time you hear me speak those words. So what's a poor scribe to do? I'm going to copy a device pioneered by the late, great Alistair Cook when he used to record in New York for his weekly Letter from America broadcast for the BBC, who would put it out, a little later, to audiences in Britain and the rest of the globe via the BBC's World Service. If events looked like overtaking him, he would simply end his consideration of any given topic by saying, "And the rest you know." Well, if you do know the rest, that is, the verdict in Trump's Manhattan criminal trial, I'll venture that it won't make very much difference to you, especially since it's just one more item in a whole host of considerations flying around in the presidential contest. And that contest still, we should note, has nearly 6 more months to run. Overseas, in this year of elections happening all over the planet, perhaps the most compelling vote has been that in South Africa. It has taken place 30 years after, to be exact, 30 years and 1 month after the historic vote in 1994 that finally ended white supremacist rule. I covered that momentous election, and for those old enough to remember, I suspect few will ever forget those striking images of millions of South Africans of all races lining up for miles to cast their ballots, the first time that the 80% of the population who are black had ever, in 300 years of white domination, had the chance to express their will concerning who should lead their country. I remember interviewing Nelson Mandela the day before that election, and a little embarrassingly, as I look back, I wished him good luck, sir, for the next day's vote. He hardly needed it. He and his party, the African National Congress, won by a massive landslide. The ANC has been in power ever since. As the nation's first black president, Mandela held office for just one term, even though the Constitution allowed him two. He stepped away in an act of graciousness that has seemed totally beyond many of his successors in leadership. Their fecklessness and corruption have resulted in vast popular discontent, especially over poor provision of expected services. Electricity supplies failing throughout the country present an emblematic example of that. There's also record high unemployment, especially among the often well-educated, high proportion of young people in the population, and a massive wealth gap exists across the country that shows no sign of substantially improving. The party's fear, as election day approached, that they might even lose their majority in Parliament led to a panicky marshalling of high-profile party stalwarts, heroes of their decades-long liberation war, to voice their support at last-minute rallies in the cities, townships, and countryside. The current president, Cyril Ramaphosa, is not a war hero. He didn't slip overseas to join the ANC's guerrilla army, but stayed home, facing the internal risks of campaigning against apartheid as a labor union activist. He will now retain the presidency, but the serious eroding of party loyalty this time around has proved an unnerving experience for a once confident movement, raising the ghostly prospect of eventually losing power completely. South Africa's media, not least the doughty Mail and Guardian, which was once the persistent thorn in the side of white racist leaders, have been repeating the ancient warning, ever true, that while you have to earn a people's appreciation to gain power in a democracy, you also, inevitably, have to keep on earning it to retain that power. That's all from the Media Beat this week. If you have been, thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, David. We will talk to you next week. David can be found at themediabeat.us.